You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 16th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Spandex.
Sorry.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
So in 1972, we had the launch of Apollo 16 from Cape Canaveral, Florida. The second to last Apollo mission.
Yay. Was that the one with Tom Cruise? Tom Hanks. No, wait.
I wouldn't mind putting Cruise in orbit.
Sorry, I'm still thinking about spandex.
Bob. Should we explain why Jay blurted out spandex?
Let's explain why Jay blurted out spandex, because right now our listeners are scratching their heads and wondering why we all lost our minds. You know, a few weeks ago, we were all chatting, and I thought it might be a good idea to institute a little game whereby before each episode, I would decide upon a word that we would have to work into conversation smoothly.
And in context.
And in context. And the first person to do so would win.
So guess what this week's word was?
Well done, Jay. You win this week.
I had to win, man.
So let's talk about Scientology, because I love me some Scientologists.
This kind of B actor named Jason Behe, you know, he's like the second guy.
No relation to Michael.
No. He's been on a lot of TV shows. I linked to his Wikipedia, and you can take a look at him on IMDb. But basically, you know, his face is out there. He's not, I wouldn't say wholly unknown. So he, in 1994, he started taking classes with the Church of Scientology, and he, over the years, worked his way up to, you know, he's considered to be top rank, right up there with Tom Cruise and all the other clears and above, because there's definitely stations above clear.
So doesn't that mean you just paid the most money or something?
Yes. Yeah, so it comes down to you've forked over enough cash.
Right.
Approximately, what, $270,000?
Something like that.
I don't think the church just will let you get up that high. Like they check you out. You have to qualify.
Well, you go through the stages, Jay, but each stage just costs money.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can't do it in a year. If you threw them $10 million, I still don't think they'd put you to the very top in a year. Like, they got to brainwash you, too.
Yeah, they would. If you're giving them $10 million, you're already brainwashed. They've done their work. They take your money and go to the mall.
That's right.
The two things do go hand in hand, probably.
At one point, was considered to be the face of Scientology by the guy who runs the church. He did a lot of promotional videos for the church. And then, seemingly out of nowhere, he snapped and publicly started speaking out against the church. Now, I think it's quite obvious that he had a period where he started to seriously question whether or not these promises that the church makes are legit. And he brings up an example in the 3-minute video. But the real thing is that 3-minute video is actually a snippet of a 3-hour video that was done. And I think this is going to be one of the biggest and best exposés on the church that we're ever going to see.
Mm-hmm. Very exciting.
They haven't announced when they're going to do it. It's pretty serious. He hooked up with Operation Clambake, which, if the listeners don't know, is an organization basically anti-Scientology. They do a very good job. Lots of great information on their website.
Xenu.net.
Yeah, it's operationclambake.net.
That's next week's word.
I have a lot of links in my blog entry if you want to see the video and read about some of these things. And overall, it's just out of the blue, very surprising, a high person in the church that's speaking out, and it just really hasn't happened this good yet. This is a good
It just dawned on him that he couldn't control his salinity. I mean, is that what happened?
I don't think it just dawned on him. I think it was a slow process. You know, at one point, I think he was really head over heels for the church. I mean, there's some quotes of him out there. He drank the Kool-Aid, but somehow he pulled himself out of that tailspin.
Because I do wonder, with that kind of a process, like with Scientology, where you're being told to believe in magic, you know, that not only magic, but tangible things in your life. And at some point, when those things are not manifest, there's got to be a pretty significant level of cognitive dissonance. Now, what most people would do is just go deeper, you know, down the rabbit hole when that happens, and they just go into denial, and they convince themselves that the magic is real. But it's interesting that occasionally somebody might say, wow, you know what? There is no magic. This is not real. None of the things – I'm not flying. You know, I'm not whatever you think you were going to be doing when you got to – when you became clear, did not come to manifest.
Well, it's not just that, Steve. He mentioned in the video that they moved the goalposts. Mm-hmm. They said, oh, well, you know, now you got to do this, and now you got to do that, and that wasn't there beforehand. So he realized that. He also said that people that shouldn't have been having like symptoms, like one of the people was having migraines. You know, he very powerfully stated that that person should not be having migraines because they're supposed to be able to, you know, get rid of the engrams that would cause that. And,
yeah.
You know, he put it together. And, you know, the thing is, Steve, the church has dropout.
Yeah.
We're just not people that were this high up in the church. And it's going to – I think it's very possible that this could damage the church. I really
do. And let's be clear. Like, the church has a large amount of dropout. You don't hear from them because – the church is not a church. It's a scary ass cult, and they will sue you, or they will track you down, and they'll make sure you don't ever get a job again. They'll make you think you're going nuts. They'll stalk you. They'll accuse you of being a pedophile. All of these things are pretty clearly on record. They've done it to so many people in the past. If you go to xenu.net, which is the address for Operation Clambake, don't go to another address. It's xenu.net. They have all sorts of information about Operation Snow White, just scary, scary conspiracies that they come up with. So, yeah, I think most people who do manage to leave Scientology, just they'd prefer to just be quiet about it and slink away in the hopes that they, you know, won't get their lives trashed.
They just want to go on with their lives.
Right. So good for him for risking that and speaking up. And that's the whole impetus behind Anonymous. It's getting bigger. Started in January, an internet group of hackers got together and attacked a Scientology website. And from there sort of evolved into a legitimate group that's protesting Scientology and encouraging other people to learn more about the cult and to take away, for instance, their nonprofit status when, in fact, they're a for-profit business. The most recent protest was April 12th, and the theme of it was Scientology's disconnection policy, which is where they encourage cult members to disconnect from family members and friends who aren't Scientologists. But the whole reason why it's called Anonymous, the group that's protesting, is because you have to be anonymous in order to criticize the church without fear of litigation, for instance, or just their crazy
harassment,
stalking
yeah.
techniques. Yeah,
they have a term they use for people that are enemies of the church.
There's suppressive persons. SPs is the the normal term. And what's great is there are people who are kind of embracing that. That's usually what ex-Scientologists are termed, suppressive persons, and they've started kind of embracing that. Like, yes, okay, I'm an SP. Why are you so scared of me? Why don't you talk to me and find out more?
That is a feature of cult in general. They cut you off from your other support structures, your family, your friends, and also anyone who would criticize the cult or your involvement in it.
Right.
That's SOP. And you mentioned Scientology's nonprofit status, which they gained, I think, about, was that like 10 or 15 years ago in the U.S.?
It was in 92, I think.
Yeah, about 16 years ago in the U.S. Recently in the news was the fact that in Texas, there is a proposal to take away Scientology's tax-exempt status in the state of Texas.
I think that happened, actually. I think it passed. So way to go, Texas.
Yeah, so I hope maybe that'll be the beginning of a trend.
Hopefully.
The next news item has to do with vitamins. And Evan, you sent me this piece. Can you just give us the quick summary?
Yeah. So according to this article, there is a comprehensive study that vitamins A, C, and E are, quote, a waste of time and may even shorten your life. After reviewing 67 studies involving more than 230,000 men and women, experts say there is no convincing evidence that taking supplements of antioxidant vitamins A, C, and E make you healthier. In fact, they had some indications that it could even shorten your lifespan if you take too much of these. And this is, I don't think, surprising to us. You know, we've been taking a look at this over many, many years. And, you know, Steve, certainly you've talked about it and written about it.
Yeah, we've talked about individual studies that have cropped up that have shown that these individual vitamins or some of the antioxidants, not only did they not necessarily have any benefit, but there's, you know, some interesting biochemical, biological implications that may actually be negative. So they may actually have some negative effects, and we're actually starting to flesh out why that might be. There was a Scandinavian study that we talked about, I think, about 6 months ago that just looked back at, you know, it was retrospective, just looked back at, you know, a large cohort of people that they followed over time, and it did look like the mortality rate was a little bit higher among those people who were taking a lot of vitamins. But again, that's retrospective data is always difficult to interpret because you're not controlling for all the variables. And this, too, this was not a study. This was a review of existing studies. And it was a British review. You know, it does gain power by looking at so many, you know, subjects, 230,000 people. You know, so it's a lot of data. So anyway, I don't think that this is the final word on these vitamins and their net health effects. But what it shows is that just because it's a vitamin doesn't mean that it's necessarily harmless. And that, you know, the antioxidant hype has gotten way ahead of the scientific evidence. Things are always more complex than they at first seem. And the nice, clean story of oxidative stress damages cells and causes aging, antioxidants will block it and make you live longer and healthier. Biology is never that simple and never that clean. And I think this is a bit of a wake-up call. It's like, you know, we have to take everything seriously and we have to look at the evidence, regardless of what makes sense or what doesn't make sense.
Wow. So the daily vitamin thing, you know? I mean, a lot of people take – I take a daily vitamin.
I know. They're Flintstones and they taste like cherry.
And how many billions of dollars a year do people spend on vitamins? Yeah. I mean, the industry is enormous. And it's certainly not going to go away based on this evaluation of these comprehensive studies.
I mean, we even supplement milk with vitamin D, right? I mean, it's everywhere.
Yeah, although vitamin D, there is actually a lot of evidence that vitamin D, that we do need to actually be supplementing milk with vitamin D, and that was actually a very positive, you know, healthcare public health measure. Fortifying salt with iodine, you know, reduced the incidence of goiter. So there are some public health initiatives where specific supplementation has been. The evidence shows that it works, but again, that's why I said routine, just multivitamins, hasn't really been supported by evidence. No matter what it is you're talking about, you have to look at the bottom line evidence because it may not be what you expect.
So I should stop eating my Flintstone vitamins every day.
Oh,
huh?
No way. Those things taste great.
Betty is just so yummy.
Betty, I like Barney. I've always been partial to Barney.
Always suspected that.
Explains a lot.
The next news item is a bit of technology news. So let's go to Bob.
This is one of those products that I think we'll be hearing a lot about. Software developer and artist Vic Oliver is part of a team developing a 3D printer that can print itself.
Oh, this is awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty, kind of awesome. Pretty cool. Technically, it's called a replicating rapid prototyper, or RepRap for short. Now, rapid prototyping first appeared in the 80s and was used to make prototypes and model parts, and nowadays they're using it for other things, and even some high quality items that are being produced by these prototypers. 3D printing is just one way to make rapid prototypes. Other ways, and there's many, include some of them are electron beam melting, which makes prototypes out of metal, stereolithography, which uses lasers to harden a resin. 3D printers build up successive layers of the medium that they lay down, like plastic, until you have a three-dimensional object. So it's a pretty simple idea. The method is generally faster and cheaper than the other method. Still, it's not cheap, though. A 3D printer can cost tens of thousands of dollars. So this is one of the big breakthroughs, as I see it, for this RepRap. It's the low cost. They're distributing the design and schematics for the printer at no cost under what's called a GNU, or General Public License. The idea is that you will take the schematics and the design, and I assume the instructions, to buy the supplies that you need. And the cost of these supplies have been estimated at about $600 to $700, which is pretty cheap for a 3D prototyper, especially one that that can actually print itself in a way. So the
I wanted to clarify that with you, Bob. It's not printing circuit boards and the electronics.
No,
it's printing the bigger parts, not the smaller parts, right?
Right. What it's doing is it could actually print the oddly shaped plastic bits that kind of hold things together for the printer. And these are not the standard off-the-shelf pieces. These are the oddly shaped pieces that you can't get. You can't just go and buy. It does not print or it doesn't create these things that you can get anywhere, like, say, the frame rods or the belts or the wiring.
Bob, it says right here in the link that you sent, RepWrap also allows people to build circuits in 3D.
Other websites I read said that it's really not at the point. You might be able to build some sort of a basic circuit, but not the stuff that you're going to run this thing on. And it can't do metal yet. It can't do any metal yet.
They're working on that, though, a low melting point metal. Yeah.
You're right, low melting point metal. They're working on that, but it's not doing that yet either. But the other important thing, though, is the general public license, in that you get this out to as many people as you can, and it's the evolvability of the device that's also very interesting. Vic Oliver was quoted as saying that we want to make sure that everything is open, not just the design and the software you control it with, but the entire tool chain from the ground up. The main goal is to have people constantly improve or evolve the printer, and then they would presumably upload these changes so that others can print the upgraded parts and incorporate the changes into their printer. So it's a constantly evolving thing. So after so many generations, you wouldn't even recognize the thing. Some interesting quotes from Chris DeBona, open source program manager from Google, said that, think of RepWrap as a China on your desktop.
Wow, that's
interesting.
The Guardian said, RepWrap has been called the invention that will bring down global capitalism, start a second industrial revolution, and save the environment.
Well, as long as we're not using any hyperbole.
Yeah, right. There you go.
I like the quote from the guy. Go ahead, Bob. You can read it.
We know that people are going to use the printer to try and make weapons and sex toys and drug paraphernalia, he says. This is obviously not what we're hoping they're going to build. We're hoping that they're going to build more and better RepWraps. So,
you know what that reminds me of?
Yeah.
That's the internet.
When they turned on
sure
the internet.
You're not going to put porn on the internet.
Yeah, you're not going to put. People aren't going to use this to send pornography around.
Right. Well, I mean, one guy that was writing an article on this, he has one of these devices, and he fixed a piece of his blender that broke. So I guess he designed the piece, or I don't know if he has maybe he scanned the broken piece and made a digital model of it, and then I assume he just loaded that into the 3D printer, and right. Bam, he's got this piece. And
or you could imagine that before too long that when you buy something like a blender, you can go to the website of the company who makes it and download the three-dimensional
right.
specs that you could then plug right into your RepWrap and make replacement parts as needed. That may be routine.
Or even still, Steve, you will buy the 3D rendering or whatever the data file would be, and you just build it at home. So you're actually buying the right to print one.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be even further down the line when you could do things like make motors and things like that.
Right, I think a lot of technology... Manufacturing is heading in that direction, I think. Yeah. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I think we'll reach a point where manufacturing won't be, these centralized areas that, using patents and designs and to create these things and then sell them. I think people will have the ability to manufacture almost anything that they could want at the home, especially when we evolve into something well beyond 3D printers, when we got things like nanofactories.
I was just thinking while you were talking about it, Bob, this thing kind of is the first step in, creating things at home like that. Instead of having the
right.
nano
yep.
box
the
in
Star
your kitchen.
Trek replicator.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys are one unitard away from living the dream, aren't you?
How long is a unitard?
But seriously, in that kind of world, the ultimate resource is going to be information. You have the information to fabricate something, and you're paying for the right to access. The designs and the plans, et cetera, not the item itself.
Right, and then raw material,
that and raw resources, raw material
right.
and energy, things like that. The last news item has to do with the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence. This is kind of a follow-up to the Drake equation. We had discussed previously the Drake equation, which was a thought experiment about what the variables were that would determine the probability of there being other intelligent life out there trying to communicate to with us with radio technology. Well, Professor Andrew Watson...
No relation
to the other Watson, wrote an article suggesting that, you know, perhaps intelligent life is actually a lot more rare than we may have previously thought, although I think there's actually a large spectrum of what people think about how common or rare intelligent life is. And he brings up a very good point that if you just look at the time span of the Earth has about another billion years left in it if you think about just the life expectancy of our sun. And we've already been around for about 4 billion years. So with a 5 billion year lifespan, it took about 4 billion years for intelligent life to arrive. That's very late in the lifespan of an Earth-like planet, a planet that can sustain what we would recognize as life. And that's something that's always concerned me as well about the Drake equation, is that, you know, the probability of life developing the sufficient complexity that it becomes possible or probable that one branch will become technologically intelligent. And although, the big problem is, of course, that we're extrapolating from an N of one, right, from the Earth. It's the only ecosystem that we can extrapolate from. But still, that kind of implies that it's inherently an unlikely thing to occur. You know, it may be, and I often wonder, you know, when we actually can start surveying planets in the galaxy, are we going to find that 9 times out of 10 planets with life just have like bacteria and algae, and that's it, and nothing really much above that?
Well, this, even 9 times out of 10, if that's the case, still you're talking about a lot of intelligent civilizations out there.
Well, 9 times out of 10 just having algae, and then what about for the other 10? Maybe 999 out of 1,000 of those have like invertebrate type life. You know, have insects and lobsters and jellies, but nothing with a central nervous system that could support really sophisticated intelligence. And then of those that have multicellular creatures with a central nervous system, you know, how many of those are going to develop the kind of intelligence that is amenable to technology?
But Steve, ET had DNA.
Right.
You know? But I don't, yeah, again though, Steve, you know, we're extrapolating from one life-bearing planet. So who knows? We might be an anomaly. Maybe intelligent life similar to ours evolves a lot earlier than
right.
we have. I mean, it's just pure speculation.
It's definitely interesting, but nobody knows. I mean, this is definitely interesting.
It's an interesting thought experiment at this point because we have such little data. And it really would be incredibly fascinating, you know, to live long enough to actually get some information about the distribution of life in the galaxy and in the universe, and just statistically what typically happens in worlds where life develops, because we have no idea how typical or atypical we are. That's the problem. But even still, I think that Professor Watson has a point. It may be that technological intelligence is inherently unlikely. Hmm. Well, let's go on to some of your questions and emails. The first question comes from Jason, who writes, "Hey, skeptics, I have a brother who is a born-again Christian, while I am an atheist. Naturally, this leads to some interesting debates between the two of us. One thing that keeps popping up is the age of the Earth and how scientists know how old the Earth is. As an avid listener of your podcast, I know that you rightfully ridicule whenever some religious fundamentalist gets the age of the Earth wrong. However, I can't remember a time where you explained in simple, easy-to-understand terms how scientists know what they know with regards to the Earth's age. Admittedly, I could have just missed it or since forgotten it if you have explained this. If that is the case, could you let me know if you remember the episode number of the podcast? If not, could you please enlighten myself and anyone else having a hard time relaying this info to the underinformed? Either way, thanks for all your efforts. Big fan, Jason." Well, this is a very interesting topic, and I always enjoy talking about how we know what we know, right, which is essentially what Jason is asking. You know, scientists throw out the age of the Earth as being around, you know, 4 to 4.5 billion years old. But how do we know that the Earth is as old as it is? And how sure are we of the age of the Earth? Well, it turns out we're pretty sure. We can be pretty certain that we know the age of the Earth. Here's the primary line of evidence. There's actually multiple independent lines of evidence, but they all relate to the radioactive decay of unstable elements. These are elements with a number of protons and neutrons in the nucleus that are a little unstable. They have the potential to emit a particle, like, for example, an alpha particle, which is two neutrons and two protons bound together, or a proton or a neutron or two neutrons or some combination like that, in order to move into a lower energy state. And in so doing, they become a new type of element or so-called daughter particle. For example, uranium can decay into lead and will also change the isotope, the isotope being the number of neutrons in the element. That process of decaying, of radioactive decay, is extremely predictable. Not the individual events, but if you look at it over time, it's you can apply a statistical number to it. You have a certain amount of uranium-238, and you could know statistically over time how much of it is going to decay into lead-206 over time. And certainly the longer the time, the more the statistics are reliable, right? You can't tell, you know, in the course of a minute, you know, if it's if there's going to be a decay event, but over the course of millions and billions of years, you can say with extreme precision how much of it should decay over time.
Well, Steve, I think one question that a lot of people have is at what point do those molecules or those atoms come into existence? Because, you know, when you think of the Earth is, you know, rock that existed before the Earth was the Earth. But, you know, it's not like everything that was on the Earth was created at one day, you know, where everything is born on that day.
Well, they were cooked up in a supernova.
Of course, that's a very good question, Jay. That's a necessary question to be able to answer in order for any of this to make any sense. And so the assumptions that are made when we use this line of evidence to date the Earth and the solar system is that when the solar system was a gaseous cloud, that there was basically an even distribution of elements in that gaseous cloud. So uranium-238 and the different isotopes of lead and potassium and argon and all that stuff were basically evenly distributed. So whenever anything solidified out of that cloud, it had whatever the average ratio of those elements were at that time. And that, you know, so we're talking about the solar system forming over millions of years, but that all occurred over 4 billion years ago. So, you know, pretty much most things in the solar system formed or solidified at around the same time. And then once they solidify, then, you know, the decay takes place at a steady rate over time. Now, creationists often challenge the dating of the Earth and the solar system by saying that, well, that's just an assumption and you don't know if that's true. You're just assuming that the distribution of these elements was uniform in the early solar system. But actually, that assumption has been tested, because what you can do is look at the ratios of these different isotopes so that way you know how much has decayed from one to the other and therefore how much time must have gone by. And if the assumption that the distribution was uniform at the beginning is correct, then those ratios should fall on a line as you look at things of different apparent age. And in fact, they do. They do fall on a line. And that wouldn't happen. They would be random. If the distribution were random, then the plot would be random. But the plot is this nice linear relationship. So that actually validates the assumption that the distribution was uniform at the beginning. Also, we could look at different radioactive decay. So we could look at, you know, again, uranium into lead, but there's also other elements, you know, one decaying into the other. So there's multiple different ones. And when you look if you date the solar system and date the Earth by these various methods, you get dates which fall in between about 4.29 billion years to about, looking for the biggest number, I think it's 4.57 billion years. That's a pretty narrow range. That would not be the case if these assumptions that we're making were not true. So that is a test of those assumptions. That's a lot of agreement, you know, over completely independent lines of evidence. You know, 4.3 to 4.5 billion years.
Not 6,000.
Yeah, not 6,000 or 100 billion. I mean, it's, you know, and then I always laugh when I read those creationists. I say, oh, the different dating methods don't agree with each other. Yeah, but they're talking about that kind of a difference, you know. That's pretty precise considering what we're doing. It's also worth mentioning that the creationists have come up with their own dating methods. for the Earth that they argue says the Earth is has to be very young. But they're all wrong. I mean, and they're like pathetically wrong. One example that one thing that they used was the thickness of the dust on the moon. They said that, you know, dust is accumulating on the Earth at this rate. If we assume that the moon is accumulating dust at around a quarter of the rate, since it has, you know, less gravity and less surface area, then over 4.5 billion years, it should have accumulated 100 feet of dust on the surface of the moon, and the Apollo lander would have sunk down 100 feet when it tried to land on the surface of the moon. Those calculations were using an estimate for the rate of dust accumulation from space, basically on the Earth, that was off by more than by several orders of magnitude. They just used bad numbers. They used bad numbers because they were wrong in the direction that they wanted.
Why don't they just look at things like the Grand Canyon? How long would it take that river to create the Grand Canyon?
Well, Joey, Jay, the flood crossed the Grand Canyon, right?
3 days of rain?
40 days and 40 nights, that's what it took? The next question comes from Ben Morris from Australia, and Ben writes, "Hey guys, found you guys on Dig a couple of months ago." Hey, that whole Dig thing works, I guess. "And I just can't get enough of your earlier episodes. I found myself worrying about what happens once I reach the start. Anyways, was eating in front of the telly last night and caught a story on Today Tonight about magnetic water. It doesn't appear to be on YouTube at the time of writing, but here's an article from the Today Tonight show. Is there nothing magnets can't do? I get the impression that the company behind this, Water for Life, has taken the opportunity to cash in on Australia's recent drought and water shortage, which has been prominent in the media for a couple of years now. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the matter and the scientific evidence behind it."
I read the article that he was referring to. The article itself is just not all that impressive. It sounds more like an advertisement for this company than anything. But in any case, here's what they're talking about in the article. So this company called Omni Water for Life, and I checked out their website, and they make magnetic systems that magnify water, amongst other things that they do. And they claim that magnetic water treatment occurs through a phenomenon called magnetic hydrodynamic resonance under the action of Lorentz's force.
Them's a lot of fancy words.
Yeah, that's the key parameters that influence the magnetic treatment are velocity of water flow in the pipe and the intensity of magnetic inductions that result in changing water structure, resulting in increased water productivity. That's right. That's right from their website.
Yeah, that's pure pseudobabble.
Yeah. I mean, you know, certainly, yes, Lorentz's force is a real force that exists in describing electromagnetic force, but, you know, so what? I mean, they're claiming that if you use their magnetic water system, your crop increase in your plants, your yields will increase by 10%, 20%, 30%, depending on what you're trying to grow.
With less water, and you can use...
With less water. And, you know, an example they give is they interviewed this farmer, Jim Rippies. He's Australia's largest strawberry farm. He calls it magic water, you know, because I don't think he really knows exactly what's
magic.
Going
Good
on.
Well,
and frankly, I don't even think this company knows exactly what's going on.
Nor do they care.
But, you know, yes, you can magnetize water. Water is magnetic, but it doesn't remain. But you put it through a pipe, and you wrap magnets around the pipe or a magnetic coil of some kind. And yes, it does align the water to its magnetic principles. But once it's done, and once it's out the pipe, and it all falls apart.
Water is liquid. Magnetized. Water flows. So sure, you might be flipping those dipoles, those dihydrogen oxide dipoles a little bit when they pass through the magnetic field if you had a really strong magnet. But but then it's a liquid. They just then randomize again once they get through. It does nothing. And all of this has nothing to do with what this company is selling it for, which is that the water acts like more water. It functions even more water is supposed to function. It's more.
They just call it better water productivity. I mean, what does that really even mean?
It's crap. It means nothing. It's just completely vacuous. You should look at their website, and you know, we get a lot of questions of, hey, there's this website, is it legitimate or not? And there's a few red flags on this website, and you should always think about this when you're evaluating some company's website that's selling you a product.
Flashing multicolored text.
Well, there's some design elements that usually tip you off, but this one actually is a pretty slick looking, pretty professional looking website. But it's chock full of claims. There's a button for testimonials.
Oh yeah, big about testimonials.
So big on testimonials, big on claims. There's a lot of information, you know, that's just there just to have lots of information on the website. But there isn't, conspicuously absent, is any listing or reference to actual published scientific legitimate papers. There's no actual evidence presented on this website. On their website, they have pages dedicated to talking about how important water is, as if somehow that bolsters their claim. So they have some of the primary properties and functions of water in the body. Water is the bulk material that fills empty spaces in the body. Wow, I never knew how important water was in the body.
Water is the essence of moisture.
Right. I mean, it's just incredible.
Here's what they write, Steve. Drinking water separates the sensations of thirst and hunger.
So if you drink water, you won't be as thirsty anymore?
I mean, or hungry.
Without water, nothing lives.
Okay. Well, if they just, you know, boy, I mean.
So that's their sales pitch? Their sales pitch is that water is kind of important?
It's embarrassing. And, you know, Steve, you said you mentioned that there's no, you know, they don't put up any evidence. They don't put up any links to studies or anything, although they do claim that there is a study that is conducted or has just been completed at the University of Western.
Vague references to study that's about to be published and blah, blah, blah. That's also a huge red flag. So this is crap.
Crap-based.
Thanks for the email, though.
Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Eric Avery. Eric, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's great to be here.
Now, Eric, as many of our listeners may know, was the original bass guitarist for Jane's Addiction and currently has out a new solo album called Help Wanted. So, Eric, why don't you tell everybody why we're interviewing you on The Skeptic's Guide podcast? How did you become a skeptic?
Well, I think, like many people, at this point in time, I got inspired to seek out the skeptical community just because I have been a fan of science my whole life and I am skeptical by nature. And I think that in the current climate of all the religiosity and the fundamentalism in media and everything, I sort of got inspired to seek out, you know, people, a voice that sort of represented me. And so I did some research, found Michael Shermer, went out to see Michael Shermer speak at Caltech, and then just started exploring the net and found you guys many moons ago and have been with you ever since. And so I've been directly connected with you guys on this because I was actually putting together the concept for the title of my solo record, which is Help Wanted. And what I came up with was connecting the idea that in times of uncertainty that people seem to refer to these sort of magical thinking in a sense to give oneself some solace and some belief that one is sort of in control of one's life because one has the secret answer behind everything, whether it be the conspiracy theory or the fact that we're all being visited by aliens or... And so in the artwork of the CD, I was working with the artist and we were talking about these ideas and it dawned on me that a lot of it was born from, you know, inspiration from people like yourselves and thinking about, you know, sort of skeptical ideas and, you know, thinking about how people react to the world, you know, reach for these sorts of things like UFOs and as some sort of a panacea.
Right, because there's a picture of a UFO on the cover of your album, but that's not, I guess many people might think that that's an endorsement of belief in UFOs, but if you combine it with the title, Help Wanted, what you're really saying is that people are reaching out for help, so they're seeking out belief in things like UFOs.
Exactly, and the way that it was conceptually put together was, it's a UFO in the front, and then on the back of the artwork, I wanted there to be the implication was that people use the ideas of like UFOs and things like that as sort of a drug to sort of anesthetize themselves. And so we had the artist put together a bunch of little UFOs spilling out of a pill bottle, mm-hmm. like a prescription yeah. pill bottle yeah. back. So,
have you read Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World?
I don't think so. No, I haven't.
Just because that theme Carl Sagan hits pretty directly in that book, where he says that in times of national crisis or anxiety or uncertainty, we reach for our more primitive instincts. Belief in things like hobgoblins and demons. So that just that's exactly what you were saying.
Yes, interesting. I mean, that's not surprising. I mean, Dr. Sagan is just he's the father of it all,
Certainly one of our icons. We quote him a lot.
Eric, you've been around the world with your band and got to see a lot of places, and I'm sure you've met tons of people along the way. Do you have any stories of anything weird you've seen or any crazy stuff that you might want to share with us?
Well, not necessarily crazy, but actually I was telling a story the other day and the person said to me, the skeptics might be interested in this story, just because it's sort of a mundane application of analytical scientific thought to a very typical rock situation, which is I was in Tokyo and we were at a dinner that was being thrown by the record company. And so we were in sort of a back room, long table sort of situation. And everyone was drinking where they put a shot of sake down into a bigger glass of beer. And mm-hmm. then they drank it all together. And in so doing, they got the sake glass stuck at the bottom of the glass once it was empty. Mm-hmm. And people were trying to bang it on the table to try to get it to loose it from the bottom of the glass.
Right.
And people were absolutely flummoxed. And so I was looking at the situation and I thought, there's got to be some sort of a expansion, contraction, using heat or something, frictions. And then I hit on the idea and I asked them to pass me the glass and I stuck it under the table. And then I just rubbed my hands on the outside of the glass, knowing that that would heat up the outside glass in relation to the glass inside,
right.
And then create room for the, and then sure enough, I just, brought it back out from under the table and then tipped the glass over and brought the sake shot glass out.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was just amazed as if it was, I had done some sort of a magic trick, But it was right. such a simple, simple scientific principle,
And then you got laid, right?
So laid.
That's part of the story, right?
They're all science stories end that way, don't they?
We wish. So something I'm curious about is coming from your American perspective, you've been around the world, and then you come back to the United States. I mean, do you see more pseudoscience in other countries, or are we just as screwed up as the rest of the world?
Well, I would have to say I think it's sort of different. I think every place has its sort of particular bent. I would say that I think that our country is, well, this is just a fact. I mean, we're just considerably more religious than when you go through Western Europe or something like that. But I think, I was really struck by how much homeopathy there is in England, say, mm-hmm. So, right. So they're actually sort of much more evolved, I think, in the religious sense. But then really backward in the homeopathy belief, that's really well established there in a way that it's sort of more fringe here, although that's changing here as well.
Right. So people are people everywhere. It's just different cultural beliefs predominate in different parts of the world.
Yeah, I think so, definitely.
Now, let me ask you a question about the rock and roll and music industry culture, because my perspective as a complete 100% outsider, the image that trickles through the mass media is that there isn't a lot of religious belief in mainstream rock and roll music industry culture, and that's part of its countercultural mystique. Do you find that that's the case, or on an individual level, is there just as much religiosity? And related to that, how much you know, sort of rational thinking skepticism do you find among your rock and roll colleagues?
Well, I would say that I think that you're right in terms of the perception of the lack of religiosity, but I think that most of my brethren just replace that with other hooey. So it just becomes, you know, Jesus might not be cool, but tarot cards are, so, you know, or astrology.
Is there then a lot of New Age belief?
Yeah. I mean, for lack of a better term, I think there's a lot of, in a sense, I guess it's sort of reaching for icons of anti-religiosity, but with the same sort of soft thinking behind it of the religious, you know, of the typically religious. So, I don't believe in Jesus, but I believe in Aleister Crowley or, you know, some other sort of satanic thing or something that's sort of sexier, you know?
Yeah, so it's kind of a lateral move. They're not really more critical thinking.
Exactly. It's perfectly put. Yeah, it's a lateral move.
And do you therefore find yourself at odds a lot with your colleagues?
I do. I think now as I've gotten older, I don't really engage in it much anymore because, as you guys are often talking about, I don't think people's minds often get changed in the conversation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I meet any time I bring out any sort of rational thought or any of that stuff, it's usually met with the you're closed-minded or, you know, mm-hmm. not open-minded to other ideas, and so I don't really fight that fight amongst the musical community. I just sort of try to be an example of something else, and if somebody finds that interesting and seeks it out, great, and if not, that's okay too. You know, I just try to be an example by just being interested and trying to share my experience of science and of knowing things and learning things and just, you know, like that great title to the Feynman book, The Pleasure of Finding Things Out.
Right.
You know, I try to do that, you know, like pass around bits about, most recently I've been making the rounds with a YouTube video from Attenborough's Earth series, a little movie about bowerbirds, you know, because I think bowerbirds are these birds that have developed the evolutionary strategy of adorning their nest in this in really unique, beautiful interior design. And they're actually sort of dowdy birds themselves. And so they attract a female by doing this really lavish and colorful interior decorating of a really elaborate nest area. And when you show that to people, they're astonished, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think, like, in little ways like that, I try to sort of spread the good message of just what a, you know, astonishing and cool world we live in without all the having to believe in hooey and magical mm-hmm. thinking, you know,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, I see you have that video on your website, and it's just from reading this, I just want to read a couple of things from, this is the, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, though, but the Wundercommer a link on your website, A Corner of the Universe, you write, "The theory of evolution is beautiful." And then later on you write, "Believing in gods is fine. I don't, but I get why it would be nice. I prefer the wonder that is produced when I consider the creative way evolution has produced this remarkable world." So, and just from what you were just saying a moment ago, that sounds like the general approach you're taking is not to be negative about what other people believe, but to just say, "Hey, science is wonderful. I think it's really cool. Check it out."
Exactly. Because I sort of feel like a lot of times a lot of these topics, whether it's politics or anything else, it gets really shrill really quickly because mm-hmm. I think that people fall into sort of grooves and patterns that the preconceived notions that they just immediately slip into and roles they play. So I've always thought that the most effective way to change people's minds is to just offer an attractive alternative instead.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. I mean, there's so much to hate out there and so much to get frustrated by. In the end, you know, there's very few times where you really do help someone or turn someone around by preaching to them about skepticism and everything. If anything, you know, I've gone around and pissed off just a lot of friends and family in my life.
Yeah, now, haven't we all, I think?
Yeah.
We try to balance it on the show. You know, obviously we criticize those who deserve to be criticized, but we try to balance that with a positive view of, you know, reason and science.
Well, I was just going to say, I also think you guys do a really good job, especially when I've heard Stephen debate people. Like, there was the Buddhist guy, I forget his name, but about cognition and all that stuff, you know. You know, I think it's fascinating also and inspiring to hear the debate as well, you know. So that has its place in the whole sort of movement as well, I think. So,
well, how about did you get a chance to meet anyone that was really cool, or, you know, it could be as simple as just someone else in another band that, you know, most people don't know about, or do you have any interesting pieces of information from having that access to those people?
You haven't had any run-ins with Alice Cooper, have you?
No.
No, it's just he and James Randi are old friends, so
it's kind
of,
oh, really?
one of the other few rock artists I think that we know that are kind of, you know, into skepticism, science, and all that. Yeah.
Well, there's Brian May. He's an infrared astronomer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Guitarist for Queen.
Yeah, he actually just finished the English equivalent of a dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
Did he?
Yeah, yeah. A good friend of mine. The drummer from the Foo Fighters, his name is Taylor Hawkins, and he's really good friends with the guys from Queen. And so I got all these reports about Brian May's Cambridge-educated astronomy, you know.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask you a question about Hawkins and the Foo Fighters, because from what I understand, they, at least, I don't know if every individual in the band, but the band has endorsed HIV denial. So they got on our bad boy list for doing that. Is that something you've heard about, or has Hawkins ever talked to you about that?
No. What's that?
So the denying that HIV causes AIDS.
That's bizarre.
The Foo Fighters supported that. They're
on record as saying that.
What did they do? They opened a event or something for that. Yeah, they're definitely on record for supporting that notion. So we discussed that at one time on the show. So that was a very disappointing. It's always disappointing to hear things like that. You know, that some group or star or whatever has bought into some bit of nonsense and is using their fame to promote it. But being his friend, you were not aware of that.
No, no. I'd be surprised if I spoke to Taylor if he felt strongly enough about it. Either way, I'm sort of surprised actually to have come out against it. Against the science of it, I wonder what anyone's thinking. I don't even understand how one would begin to think that. So
yeah, well, it's a pretty elaborate pseudoscience.
Yeah, well, I guess all the craziness over the all the vaccines and the anti the autism causing vaccine scare and all that.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how these things grab a hold. And it's funny, too, because it's sort of easy. Like, I've always been struck by how easy it is to make the medical profession bad guys, you know.
Yeah.
Because no one likes to go to the doctor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to say, like, yeah, aren't they? It's sort of like lawyers or something, you know. It's like it's easy to make them bad guys, sort of.
Yeah, anything that's establishment is an easy target.
And it's not all that unusual, you know, that you know someone you certainly think you know somebody or what their thoughts are on some of these things, and certainly they could have the correct ideas and come to the correct conclusions about a lot of different things, but then there's that one thing, almost call it a sacred cow, if you will, that they just can't get past or can't get a good grasp of.
Well, I think, you know, if you're not a science wonk, you know, like we are, and you get hit by a very organized, sophisticated, developed pack of pseudoscience, it's easy to get overwhelmed by it if you don't have the background information to filter through it. And then once you're sort of inside that world, it's hard to get out of it. The article that I'm reading makes it sound as if the Foo Fighters bassist, Nate Mendel, is the big one who's into the HIV denial.
Mm.
I don't know if you know
him. Wow. Yeah, I do, and that's sort of the most surprising, because I would credit Nate as being sort of the, well, I shouldn't pick favorites, but
well, Eric, you got a plan now, man. You got to go talk to these guys, and
you got to bring them back over to the side of life.
I'll
help
know.
You. I'll help you save them from the HIV deniers.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm curious to hear what he has to say, because he is a really bright guy. He's like. I think definitely sort of the sharpest mm-hmm. brightest guy in the band. And sort of, I guess, the most, I would think, most interested in things like this, things other than rock, you know. So I'm surprised. I wonder where it comes from, you know. But, you know, I like Evan was saying, I think that, you know, there are often, what I sort of most often refer to as humdingers, where there's just this thing that seems to come out of left field in otherwise, you know, sort of rational people, you know.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, and, you know, and very intelligent people can embrace this kind of stuff because, I mean, if extrapolating from the surveys and studies that have been done, it really isn't until you get to a pretty high level of science education, like postgraduate training, that belief in pseudoscience and the paranormal actually starts to decrease. That actually mm-hmm. interest in science drives belief in a lot of weird things in pseudoscience. So either you need to have a very high level of education in science, or you need to have, you know, critical thinking, which really is its own skill set. And you could be very otherwise intelligent and interested in science and curious, but if you don't have the critical thinking skill set, you can fall victims to this sort of prepackaged, sophisticated nonsense like HIV denial.
Or Eric, you could have what I have. You could have a brother like Steve who will smack you senseless if you come across. But remember when I watched Loose
Reality
Change.
Check.
And I'm like, I don't know. Holy shit, guys! Loose Change, man. It's pretty tight. Steve was like, you stupid bitch, like, smacked my face off.
Yeah, Loose Change was really popular amongst all the people that I know. Yeah.
Is that right?
And it's funny too, because I am sort of the one that gets a lot of the like, oh yeah, let's see what Eric thinks about this one. You know, this is the one that's really going to get over on him, you know.
But that's good. You're the go-to skeptic in your world. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. It's interesting.
Yeah. Be nice if there were a few more.
Right. No, it's good. You need one in every crowd, right?
I'm trying to think. Like, I have a good friend who's a musical composer, but he's not like from the, well, actually he is. In the distant past, he was like produced like all these records, like America and all these bands, but he's a better scientist than I am, certainly. And, critical thinker and super smart too. And he's somebody I feel close to. But yeah, in the rock world, generally.
Well, you have Amy Winehouse.
Right,
she's
right.
She's a brightly burning torch of science, as everybody knows.
Yeah.
So, Eric, what do you got coming up? You got you're promoting your album now, and I suppose you're going to go on tour soon if you're not already doing it.
Yeah, actually, that's probably one of the next projects is putting together some sort of a tour and a band, and actually we'll get Taylor to play drums. He's already offered his services, but I'll have to disabuse him of his erroneous belief first. Probably put together some live dates. And then just I'm just sort of doing whatever the next sort of indicated interesting thing is, and one is helping a friend of mine write her record.
How about are you coming to TAM 6 this summer?
I'm not much of a convention type person, so I've been reticent, but I was actually speaking to my wife a couple of months ago about coming to the next TAM 6 just to check it out, and I was seeing if I could get her to bite on it too, and so we'll have to see. It sounds interesting, certainly.
It'd be great if you could come say hello to us, you know.
Yeah. When is it again?
June 19th to 22nd.
June 19th to 22nd. Wow.
It's a fun time.
It's definitely a really good time. I mean, it's a total geek fest at the same time, but we're all geeks.
But in a good way.
It's good. No.
I consider myself a card-carrying geek, so.
Awesome.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, put it this way. When I was sitting with a friend of mine, he was reading through the newspaper, and he said, oh, wow, look, Gary Gygax died. And then he went, Eric, do you need a minute?
Oh shit!
Oh, no.
Yeah. Don't even get us going on that, man. But you should try to come. I think you know, the thing that blew me away about TAM. First off, there's a community. There's a real community filled with really, really good, cool people, and there's a lot of awesome discussions going on. And then you listen to the speakers, and it's just one after another of just brightly burning torches of science and skepticism and reason. Even if you come out for a day, I think you'd really get something out of it. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure I would. I mean, because I love, too, the idea that how much of the skeptical community is sort of infused with magic, mm-hmm. you know, like being such a great example of you know, sort of how easily gullible people can be and how limited our perception can be. And, you know, I love that stuff. Like, you know, Wiseman
and
Penn and Teller and certainly James Randi. Was it you guys, your guys' show where there was that great story about James Randi doing the mentalist trick with the cross, and it turned out that it was the clock in the woman's house?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a great story. Such a great story. And I love that it was something as simple as had somebody follow this woman back to her house and then go in, you know?
It's always the simplest explanation.
Yep, right.
Yeah.
Like with the shot glass, it's very simple.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that involved a little bit of science. It was still something anybody could do.
What's really incredible is if you think about Eric's shot glass story. Was Eric really the only person sitting at that table that questioned what was going on? Did everyone just assume that there was something more than just, you know, whether it was jammed in there a little bit or whatever? Like, you would just think everyone would have that instant moment of, oh yeah, it's jammed, or it's stuck in there somehow.
Well, it's funny because it was such an example of, it looked so like monkeys, you know what I mean? Because it's they're literally banging it, you know, like that's the answer. The only answer is to hit it harder, you know.
Yeah.
Very primal.
Yes.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Eric, it was a blast talking with you.
Oh, it was a pleasure. I loved it.
I want to get a follow-up on the Foo Fighters if you make any headway with them. And then I'm going to personally take credit for saving the Foo Fighters from their HIV denial through you, but I brought you that information, so that'll be fun if that comes to anything. So give us the follow-up on that.
Okay, I will, definitely.
And maybe we'll run into each other at TAM 6.
Yes, yes. It sounds great.
All right, and Eric, good luck with the new album.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Now, just for our listeners, they can download that from iTunes, and they can also buy it from your website. Or is it actually physically in record stores now?
It is. It is, both digitally and analog.
Excellent.
That's Eric Avery. Name of the album is Help Wanted.
Okay, talk to you again soon, Eric. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks, guys.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week's items?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
No theme. We are themeless this week.
Good. I hate themes.
You'll have to struggle on.
Hodgepodge.
Anyway.
Hodgepodge.
It's a hodgepodge. A potpourri, as we say. Okay, item number 1. Researchers have developed a new manufacturing process that doubles the efficiency of cheap solar cells. Item number 2, scientists have discovered the world's oldest tree, a Swedish spruce, almost 10,000 years old. And item number 3, using computer modeling, scientists have discovered that Neanderthals were capable of a greater range of vocal sounds than humans. Evan, go first.
Researchers have developed a new manufacturing process that doubles the efficiency of cheap solar cells. Sure, why not? Solar technology is advancing, even as we sit here and record this. Scientists have discovered the world's oldest tree, a Swedish spruce, 10,000 years old. I don't know about that. Using computer modeling, scientists have discovered Neanderthals were capable of a greater range of vocal sounds than humans. Using computer modeling, I wonder how they did that.
I mean, I thought it was implied, but of their vocal apparatus, I'll say.
So I guess we have samples of Neanderthals' vocal apparatus in laboratories that we can evaluate.
Oh, he won't tell you anything more.
That's really interesting.
They love to sing.
I'm going to have to say that my gut is telling me that the solar cells one is a curveball to get us to try to think that it's science when it's actually fiction. So solar cells is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
The solar cells one really sounds wrong to me. I think I remember reading about how we really couldn't get them to be incredibly more efficient than they are right now. So that one definitely is on the list. The 10,000-year-old tree doesn't sound that crazy to me. The Neanderthals and their ability to be more vocal, That's just definitely something I don't remember reading about and I don't know much about. I would agree with Evan that, you know, how can they tell? Because I'd imagine that we only have bones from them and no tissue. And is there enough information in the bones? Look at the bones.
Can they do it?
I'm going to say that the solar cell one is the fake.
Okay. Rebecca?
I don't know. I think you can tell based on just the bones, because if you think about it, it's not just like the sounds we make aren't just your tongue or whatever. I mean, it also has to do with how much space is in your head, right? For things to bounce around, and I can see that being true. But I'm going to agree with the guys. I think that doubling the efficiency of cheap solar cells, that would be huge and awesome. And I would hope that I would have heard something about it. So I'm going to say that that one is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
The tree, I'm going to say that, that's science with the tree. I mean, 10,000 years is old, but, that's definitely within the realm of possibility. Number one, the doubling the efficiency of cheap solar cells. I think the operative word there is cheap, because when you get the when you start talking about expensive solar cells, the efficiency goes up. So the fact that they doubled cheap solar cells makes that more likely. So I'm going to say that is science as well. The Neanderthals. The fact that they modeled it, doesn't surprise me. I mean, if the fossils are good enough, you can kind of get an idea of what you're dealing with, and then make some estimates and some guesses to see what you know to model it. Although, who knows how thick various tissues were? I mean, I guess you can look at muscle insertion points and stuff and get some idea. But the fact that they had greater range of vocal sounds—that's what's throwing me on that one. A greater range, that's a big surprise. I mean, it might have been greater range than we anticipated, but greater than humans. Or maybe they had greater range, but they couldn't control it the way we can. I'm still going to say that the Neanderthal is fiction.
Okay, so you're going to go against the crowd on that one, huh?
Yeah.
All right, so you all agree that there's a Swedish spruce almost 10,000 years old. And that one is science.
Is this one of these trees that's like embedded in a swamp underground that they dug up or something like that?
No, it's a living tree. Right. It's alive.
And it's in
Sweden,
actually, right?
It's 9,550-year-old spruce, so almost 10,000 years old. I was hoping that somebody would bite on it because of the round figure, but that's That's pretty darn old. These kind of trees can actually grow new trunks. So
trunks?
Yeah. So that helps them survive through bad periods and a climactic change and trauma.
Yeah, how do you do that?
It could actually spread by sprouting. You know, some plants will send shoots under the ground and just come up as another part of it.
Oh, yeah, or a banshee tree.
This does that, but in addition, it could actually just sort of migrate over to a new trunk when it needs to keep itself
going. So
where
is the tree?
In the Swedish mountains, from the Lapland in the north to Dalarna in the south, they found a cluster of about 20 of these spruces, all over 8,000 years old, and the oldest of which
is
9,550 years old.
They didn't cut one open and count the rings, did they?
You can take a little core sample.
They did carbon-14 dating on some of the samples of the wood.
Wow.
Not dendrochronology.
Yeah, they would have had to, because otherwise, if you've got a new trunk, then you're not counting rings.
Yeah, the ring counting wouldn't do it.
That's incredible.
Imagine you're the guy, you have to count 10,000 rings.
Yeah, 6,520. Oh, I lost my count. Damn it. Start over. One, two.
Previously, pine trees in North America were cited as the oldest. They're between 4,000 and 5,000 years old. So this is like almost doubling the
baby.
So, Steve, where were humans 10,000 years ago?
Yeah, so, well, didn't you see that movie?
No.
fighting saber-toothed lions.
Well, in Atlantis, they were having nuclear wars, I think.
Yeah, so 10,000 years ago, that's a long time. I guess 8,000 BC, so, you know, there were people maybe farming around the River Nile, but there wasn't really in Egypt yet.
And the glaciers retreated, what, 13,000 years ago?
Is that the oldest living thing?
Yeah.
That is, you know, if there's anything on the planet that should that is worthy of respect and worship, it's that thing. It's those trees.
almost 10,000 years. That's amazing to think about all that time.
It depends. There might be some bacteria that are that have been in stasis for longer, but
a complicated living organism, a multicellular organism like a tree.
Right. Well, there you go.
Yeah, but Bob's right though. If you include stasis, there may be some bacteria that win it.
Interesting.
I've had a steak in my freezer for 2 years.
Bacteria can go dormant, and then, in fact, bacteria can go dormant and survive trips through outer space.
Yeah. Well, good for bacteria.
All right, Bob, you think that using computer modeling, scientists have discovered that Neanderthals were capable of a greater range of vocal sounds than humans. You think that is the fiction, and that one is the fiction.
Whoa,
you are correct.
Bob.
Boo.
I knew it was a curveball.
And they can obviously although that's fiction, they did model the Neanderthals' vocal cords, and they did it from the fossil from the fossil evidence, and they found that they had a narrower range of sounds. They were not capable of the rich variety of sounds that Homo sapiens can
trick
can
me
make.
Again.
So
like Barry White.
Well, Steve, I mean, but how much of that is just pure guesswork? I mean, the tissues would be so important and influential. And when you're dealing with just fossils, I mean, can you really tell with any, degree of certainty?
Well, yeah, there's uncertainty, but it's a computer model. That's what they did. They took all the information they could get to try to model three-dimensionally what the vocal apparatus would be, and, this is the kind of sound that it produced, and it looked like it was much more limited than what humans could do.
Hmm.
Which means that researchers have developed a new manufacturing process that doubles the efficiency of cheap solar cells is science.
Wow. Doubles.
And Bob.
That's big.
That's pretty cool.
Keyed in on the important word, which you're good at doing that, Bob. Cheap was the operative word in this. But this is still very cool and very huge.
Yeah.
When we're talking about commercial solar cells, the ones that are on the market right now are the silicon and glass hard brittle plates. And they're at between 10% and 12% efficiency, meaning what's the amount of light, photons that get actually turned into electricity, to around 12% efficiency. But there are a lot of companies who are researching cheaper manufacturing processes, and right now they're at about 6% efficiency. So they're cheaper, but they're not as efficient. At this point, the name of the game is, the cost per kilowatt hour. Just how much is this electricity costing? So even if it's less efficient, generating electricity overall cheaper is the key hurdle to get over in order for solar energy to be widely adapted. So they still need to get the efficiency up on these cheaper solar cells in order to get the cost effectiveness even better. And also they're trying to come up with cheaper and cheaper manufacturing processes.
So 12% is still the threshold?
It doesn't. Not necessarily. I mean, of course, the higher the better. I mean, if your efficiency is too low, no matter how cheap it is to make, then it's just not. Then the square footage becomes a limiting factor. It just becomes not worth it. If you're like less than 1% efficiency, who cares how cheap it is? You're not going to be generating enough electricity to be of any use. So, if you were at 8% or 10% less than the silicon, but you were, only cost a tenth as much to manufacture, then suddenly that becomes cost effective, and then everyone's going to have their roofs lined with, cheap solar cells. The quote unquote dye sensitized solar technology is all about cheaper manufacturing, and they're at about half or about 6% mm-hmm. efficiency. But what this study, here's one of the key dilemmas that they had. In making this sort of dye sensitized solar cells, where they have material that absorbs the photons and will turn it into electricity, you want to have the surface be very rough so that the light there's as much surface area as possible. And they've been experimenting with the optimal sized graininess of the surface, and this is the dilemma that they ran into. If you have large beads or large grains of this material, that's really good at capturing the beams of light. But it's not very good at scattering it, so it doesn't absorb a lot of it. If you have really small grains, then it's really good at scattering the light, but it scatters it and bounces a lot of it away. It doesn't capture the light very well. Does that make sense?
You want to achieve a medium. So you want to achieve the optimal balance.
Right, but it's a trade-off. You get bigger, you capture more, but you don't absorb as much. If you get smaller, you absorb more, but you don't capture as much. So what they did was they made so-called popcorn-shaped balls by using small grains and then clumping them together. So it's both big and small. You have big clumps to capture it and then the small graininess to scatter it and absorb it. Huh. So popcorn ball design, that was the key technological breakthrough. However, they did this using just to test the concept. To test the concept, they used a material that was easy to work with. The previous manufacturing process, using only small particles, yielded an efficiency of 2.4%. With the popcorn ball design, that boosted efficiency up to 6.2%.
Nice.
That's actually more than a doubling.
Wow.
Of the efficiency. Now, the next step is going to be to see if the process works with titanium oxide, which is the current dye sensitized based solar cells. So they're now at around 11% maximum efficiency. Imagine if they could double that, get up to 22%. Now you're off to the races. Then that's
but titanium is not cheap, right?
Yeah, I don't know about the cost of that. I mean, it's cheaper than right now than silicon. I mean, the amount of silicon that you have to use to make the cells are actually a significant part of the expense, especially since, you know, with the explosion of computer technology, that's using up a lot of the silicon. You know,
platinum.
Right,
that's the way to go.
Incredible. Incredible. So hopefully that will pan out, but this was like a preliminary test of concept stage, which is probably why it wasn't as big news as you imagined it should have been, doubling the efficiency of the solar cell. I honestly believe, with just based upon everything that I've been reading, that over the next 50 years, there are two energy technologies that are going to displace a significant amount of our current energy production, and are also the only two technologies that have a chance of displacing a significant amount of our carbon production. One is nuclear
solar,
and the other is solar. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the two energy technologies that I think are going to really pay off in terms of, you know, reducing greenhouse gas production and meeting our growing energy needs.
Good. Science will solve the problem.
I think so.
But that doesn't mean, Steve, that it's going to take 50 years for solar to reach parity.
No, I said over the next 50 years.
Right. Right, okay.
I think they'll be phased in. You know, we're getting to our third and fourth generation nuclear energy plants that are producing much less waste and are much more efficient and much safer. Even at current efficiencies, I think there's a lot we could do with solar, although it's not quite ready for prime time yet. But these kind of breakthroughs, and every few months I read about another breakthrough like this with solar technology, I think we're definitely going to be there.
Yeah, it really is accelerating, and we haven't even really broached the whole nano aspect of solar. And once that mm-hmm. kicks in, we could really fine tune the efficiencies and lower the cost.
Yeah,
well, I'm putting all my money in the magnetized water.
There you go.
So I'm banking.
If we could magnetize the sunlight, then we're really talking.
Ooh, magnetized
photons.
Can you do that?
Rebecca, congratulations on your wicked science or fiction run.
Which what was your total
tonight? Geez, I don't even know. We'll have to go to Mike for that. 13. And you know what? What destroyed me at last was my problem was that I actually read too many articles.
Yeah.
And
what's been hurting me.
I was right before
kidding.
Where I said that, I do so much better when I'm completely ignorant of what's going on in the news.
Rebecca, you're sexier when you lose. I just got it.
Oh, shucks. That. Thanks.
Is that her consolation
prize? Not as sexy
prize?
As you in your spandex, Jay.
Oh, she said the word.
Oh, I win.
Yeah, because Jay's thinking.
You can't win your own game.
Jay's was not in context.
About an hour too late.
Yes.
Jay.
I can't wait for next week's
Can you give us a quote to close out our show this week?
I can, and I will. This is a quote from a man named Jacob Bronowski, born 1908, died 1974. He was a British mathematician of Polish-Jewish origin. And he was best remembered as a presenter and writer of the BBC television documentary series, The Ascent of Man. Ever hear of it?
Yeah.
I've heard of it.
Recognizable if you see him. There is no absolute knowledge, and those who claim it, whether they are scientists or dogmatists, open the door to tragedy. All information is imperfect. We have to treat it with humility. Jacob Bronowski.
That's a good quote.
Yeah.
He's right.
I have a quick announcement. Expelled, the horrific Ben Stein movie, comes out this Friday, about the time that you're all hearing this. You can support the good guys by going to expelledexposed.com, Jeannie Scott's site.
And Mike Lissell, our biggest fan, has made a Facebook fan page for us for The Skeptic's Guide. So check it out and become our fan on Facebook.
Yeah, Mike will be joining us at TAM6. And anyone that's interested, we would really love to meet our listeners, and we're still asking people to come. So please go to randy.org, take a look. It's something you should do at least once in your life.
All right, guys. Well, thanks again for joining me. Another fun week.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure.
Thanks, Doctor. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.